Good afternoon. It is one bell of the afternoon watch. And this is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair for our weekly gathering. Would that we could do it more frequently, and would that we could do it for a longer period of time. But I am enormously grateful to the voice of Vashon 101.9 on the FM band and voiceofvashon.org, streamed all over the world from Singapore and one end of the world to Stockholm in the other, and all of the ships at sea and all of the aircraft in the air, all of the rescue stations in between. So I always, as my custom, reach out and touch fingertips with all that are on the binnacle list. And in the last week, as happens, some new entries on the binnacle list and some people who have been taken off and have been returned to either light duty or to full duty. And I'm adding a ship to the binnacle list. My friend and colleague John and his son Cody have reported to me that Roger Blau has been, she had a fire in the, what was the Old Bay Shipbuilding Company and is now called the Fincantieri Yard. And we've talked about Fincantieri. The Bay Shipbuilding Company was bought by an Italian company, Fincantieri. And it is now a completely U.S. company, and it is doing... And so Roger Blau was in winter layup, and she was also being worked on. She caught fire, and I, beyond the extent of damage, I know not, and John and Cody did not know, but they'll keep me posted. But Roger Blau has a particular significance to me. She is a ore carrier. She's not quite 1,000 feet long. And she was originally built by United States Steel, U.S. Steel. And when I was breaking ice the winter that I was, that I had my north wind up in the Great Lakes and breaking ice all that winter, I was at one point during that winter, I was working Roger Blau through the ice in the western end of Lake Erie. And there were just the two of us working, and Roger Blau was loaded. She was headed down to one of the mill towns. And we were having some real trouble getting her through the ice. The ice was stiff, it was ridged, and it was under pressure. So I sensed that I was pretty close to the bottom. The term there is smelling the bottom, and you can make of that what you wish. And so I called over to Roger Blau, and incidentally, in the Great Lakes, radio call signs are the full name of the ship. None of this business of abbreviations saying and being overly familiar by calling Roger or Mr. Blau or just Blau. So I called Roger Blau and I said captain to captain, and the captain came, he was up on the bridge, and I said, "Captain, we're not making really good progress here, and I suspect that we both are smelling the bottom, because in the Great Lakes, ore boats runs often with 6 inches between the bottom of the ship and the bottom of the channel." And so the captain and Roger Blau came back, and he said, "Captain Joe, you indeed are smelling the bottom. And in order to validate that, go down into your head in the captain's cabin, in the head, in the head there, and should you feel the need, use it. But in any case, flush it. And if brown water comes up into the flushing water, because aboard ship, flushing water comes from the sea, or in the case of the Great Lakes, it comes from the lakes. If you are getting brown water, then you're picking up mud from the bottom in the suction for your flushing water." So I followed his instructions. I went down to the cabin. By this time, I did indeed need to use the equipment, and then I flushed it. And sure enough, there was brown dirt coming up, and I went back up onto the bridge, and I said, "Captain, you're exactly right. We both are smelling the bottom," and what that meant was that we were so close to the bottom that we were picking up some of the bottom mud itself. So I've always had a warm spot in my heart for Roger Blau. She's a very interesting ship. She has a almost but not quite unique loading and unloading system. But because I had this very personal interaction with her and with her captain, she remains for me and for my friend, young friend Cody, one of my favorite ships in the Great Lakes. And it remains to be seen whether this fire is so severe that she will never go back into service. It would be a shame if she didn't. She was a very good ice boat, and she was managed in the ice by her captain, who was very aggressive in working with the icebreaker to make sure that she got through. So Roger Blau remains right now on the binnacle list, and hopefully she is going to be able to be returned to service. I picked up a piece during the week about the ability of a radar set to predict wave conditions, and the name of the system is called Rutter, R-U-T-T-E-R. To maritime historians, there's my friend Molly just walked by. I hope Molly can come on with me next week, and we will talk about environmental things at sea. So the word rutter, R-U-T-T-E-R, for those who are interested in maritime history, can go back and sailing directions. That's the word that I want. Sailing directions. The word rutter goes back centuries. It goes back to the probably 1500s, 1400s. And the rutter was the sailing directions that were constructed by pilots and captains as they worked their way around through the trade routes of the world. And some of the rutters were secret and were not shared, and some of the rutters were shared with other captains, and in particular with the management ashore, who would then pass it on to the other captains in their fleet. So this system uses an X-band radar for all of you electrons out there, and it collects the wave returns, the radar returns of the wave forms, and then uses that in a computer model to predict the forthcoming wave patterns so that a captain and a deck force can decide whether or not they want to put people out on deck to do some work, or possibly to tighten and snug everything down, to take a round turn on frapping lines. We'll talk about frapping lines in some future broadcast. I know you all are fascinated with those words. And here's what I have to say about that. I have a few hours starting my first ship out of the academy. Was a 2-year tour where I learned, among other things, my single screw ship handling. I was taught by a master of the art, the XO in the ship. And then from there, I moved on to my first command at sea. And I had that command for 2 years, and then in later years, I had 5 more, including my Northwind, the polar icebreaker. And in all of those years, I have been in, I believe it's 3 typhoons. I know it's 2 hurricanes, and in some of the most atrocious weather that a man can subject himself to. And it is the experience that I gained with all of that seagoing that tells me when it's safe to put my people out on deck, when it is time to rig the heavy weather bill and rig lifelines. when it is time to say that no one goes out on deck except for emergent reasons, and then only with the approval and permission of the officer of the deck. And so it is this experience that is what is going to tell me. And when the ship is rolling 45 degrees on a side and she's hanging, when she gets over on those 45 degree side and she hangs, you know she's going to come back up, but she is telling you that she is being stressed. Ships talk to their captains, by the way. And then as the waves build up, I don't have time, and I don't want my officer of the deck to have time to consult some computer program that tells him and me when it's safe for my people to go out on the weather decks. So I don't doubt that there are some people who might find this to be a comforting computer program. I find it to be something that I would not use, but I would be using instead my senses, which have been pretty finely honed as to the phenomenon about which we're talking. But what I find particularly interesting is that the name that they chose to apply to this is the word rutter, R-U-T-T-E-R, which are the old sailing directions. In other nautical and maritime news, I picked up a piece from the Naval Institute. The Naval Institute was founded in 1876. It is the forum for seagoing professionals in the military side, U.S. Naval Institute. I'm a life member of it, and I get some really interesting things. And what I got this time between our visit last week and this is something called the Navy's Comprehensive Crew Endurance Management Policy. All of you out there who have been to sea in the Coast Guard have, if you are in the search and rescue business, or if you're in the ace navigation business, or whatever type of ship it was in which you sailed, you were exposed to being so tired that you wondered whether you would get through the next hour. And yet, again, as with the rudder, the experience and the learning that comes from that experience is what gets you ready to come to the end of your watch when you get relieved and you can lay below. God made captain's chairs for captains to be able to do that. And so I would frequently get up into the captain's chair on the bridge of whichever ship I happened to be captain of, and knowing that I probably would not be able to lay below for maybe 24, 48 hours, I would rest my eyes in the chair. In two of my ships, it was unkindly reported to me by way of XO that unseemly sounds akin to possibly snoring came from the vicinity of the chair. But of course, when the captain is up in the chair, no one on the bridge is going to say, "Captain, we think that you are snoring." But if I could get half an hour resting my eyes, maybe even with a little snoring, then I would be good for another 48, sometimes 72 hours. And it is the experience that comes with going to sea early in your career and staying with it that you generate that internal clock. I still wake up in the middle of the night with Sailor and Sunshine. I wake up in the middle of the night, usually about 03:30, because that's when the watch is mustering. And captains don't stand watches normally, but captains are also very much aware when the watches change. And so I always knew, and I know today, when the watches are changing and when the bosun's mate of the watch is reporting to the officer of the deck that the watch is ready to relieve. This whole business of comprehensive crew endurance management policy came about as a result of the tragic accidents that involved Fitzgerald and the McCain, USS McCain. We've talked about both of those accidents. Both of them involved the loss of life of fine sailors. And we've talked about what the reasons for those were. And one of the things that came out of this whole series of investigations was somebody came up with the idea that maybe the crews are not getting enough sleep. So I went back and examined my own conscience, how I managed my own crews, and I managed crew rest. In Antarctica, when you are breaking into the U.S. base at McMurdo, you break ice, the sun is out 24 hours a day, and you break ice 24 hours a day. And in fact, you do it at night, up in the Great Lakes if you have to. If you let everybody stop and sit for a while, you get frozen in and you have to break everybody out. In McMurdo, it's necessary to follow the operations order, because you've got ships that are waiting to come through the channel that you're breaking and cutting in order to resupply the base at McMurdo. So it's not a choice that you have to pull over to the side and everybody get 8 hours of rest. Well, one of the things that came out of this investigation was some approach that involved something called the circadian rhythm. Now, ships have been using a port and starboard, four on, four off, or a three-watch system, four on, eight off, for centuries. And the reason for that is that over those centuries, we've figured out that a crew can manage with, if they have to, and they're trained to, and they're experienced to, be on watch 4 hours, and then have a 4 hour stand down, and then they go back on watch. Port and starboard watches are really rough on everybody, and I've had to impose port and starboard watches only a couple of times in my career. But I have always used the 4-on, 8-off system. It was good enough for the Phoenicians, and it's good enough for your captain. And so this instruction, which came out as part of this management policy, get ready for this. You're going to really like this one. If I know my Captain Joe's people, ComNav Surf Pack instruction and ComNav Surf Lant instruction 3120.2 alpha. I read the preamble to that, and I decided that this was an instruction that I would exercise the part all the way down at the bottom, which says, commanding officers are ultimately responsible for the health and safety of their crew. And that's the part that I would chose many, many times to exercise, and would choose if I were subject to this particular instruction. I can sit up in the chair and I can tell how my crew is doing. And I can tell when it's necessary to remind XO and for XO to remind department heads that it's time to make sure that the people who are standing watches, or the people who are actually managing the controls, or the people down in the engine room who are responding to the needs of the ship as she's breaking ice. And you do it 24 hours a day, and you back and ram, you back and slam into the ice. And sometimes when the ice is very thick, or it's very hard, or it's under pressure, or it's under ridging, sometimes you only make a few feet on each brack and ram cycle. One year, it took me 2 weeks to break 24 nautical miles from the ice edge into the U.S. base at McMurdo. You don't get to stop. You don't get to quit. What the good captain does is he husbands his stores for the long voyage, and his most important stores are his hands, his crew. And he's the one that decides, and he's the one that instructs XO, and XO instructs the department heads, and all the way down through the chief of the boat and all the way down to the newest hand working in the bilges, that it is necessary to get rest, but you also, by experience, school yourself to be able to go that extra nautical mile when it is required of you. I just think that this is a very interesting thing, and the some of the policies that went into what is euphemistically called the Comprehensive Crew Endurance Management Policy came from the Naval War College. Now, I don't know how many people in the Naval War College at various levels of schooling are experienced captains. I suspect not many, because in the Navy, it is not at all uncommon for a first command to be a destroyer. And in my service, people who are experienced have come up through the command ranks, and that's where their experience comes from. So the one of the lines in the Crew Endurance Handbook, which is part of this whole program, is a cultural resistance to maybe admitting we are taking naps. Sailors down in the berth decks, instead of playing games on their computers, and now we probably have them in ships. They certainly didn't have them in my ships, but they probably have them in ships now. Instead of playing games, they're told to hit the rack so that they can be rested and ready to go to work. In the aviation industry, Captain O'Brien reminded me that it was in particular the Airline Pilots Association that was particularly pushing about crew rest for airline captains and first officers. In my own service, there are mandatory crew rest requirements for those who fly the airplanes. There are mandatory aircraft rest requirements. The aircraft that I carried in my Northwind, I had two of them, and I had four complete crews, four aircraft commanders, four co-pilots, four sets of maintenance and air crew. And that was because there were crew rest requirements for the crews, and those were mandatory. I could exceed those only on emergency, and of course I would be then responsible and accountable, but then of course the captain is responsible and accountable for even that brand new fireman apprentice down in the bilges who lets a rag get sucked up into a bilge suction. So all of these things have to be susceptible to common sense, and in the final analysis, it is the captain who must be both responsible for and must be making sure that his people are properly rested and not coming from some instruction like ComNav Surf Pack Instruction 3120.2A, partially crafted in the Naval War College. And that is what I have to say about that. So in the couple minutes that we have left, I have a couple of short pieces that bear on other things that we have talked about. One of them is that the business about containers being lost over the side, you all will recall that we have talked about, and I have brought to your attention the fact that you may well be missing a pair of sneakers because they are in a container which is bobbing around to the northwest of Hawaii'i, having gone overboard from a container ship that had lost containers overboard. And you all will recall that in one case, there were 2,000 containers that got lost off of a very large container ship. So this is there is a call for an investigation of how we are loading containers, how we're clipping them down, how we are securing them for sea, and how high we pile them up on these very large container ships. The article, however, does not say who is making this call, so I'm going to take credit for it, because in our discussions, in our conversation about this subject, I said it is time for us to talk about container ships, how they're being loaded, how high the containers are being loaded, and the way that they're being managed in heavy weather. There are places in the world where ships are sailing on regular trade routes, where the weather can change quickly, dramatically, and unpredictably. With all of this wonderful computer programming and computer ways of predicting weather, it is still quite possible, and I have been in them, to be in weather that didn't show up until you're in the middle of it. So I don't know who is actually calling for this, because the article doesn't say, and nor does it say who is going to actually do this investigation. My own recommendation is that it would come from the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, which has its headquarters in London, right near Blackfriars Bridge. But whoever's going to do it, I'm going to take credit for having said it is time for us to do this. And I would be perfectly happy to be recalled to active duty and be put on to the task of figuring this out. And the first thing I would say is we need to look at those corner clips, and maybe we need to even install some preventers, some straps to go across the top. Those straps would be really long and very, very difficult to manage. But there are better ways to do it, and there have to be better ways to do it. If there are not, then we need to stop doing this. We need to stop sending these ships to sea stacked 10 high or 12 high. In the same vein, I have also talked about car carriers and their propensity to roll over when the cargo, the cars, become unsecured from the lashings on deck. So there's an interesting development there that there is a company now proposing that the hull form, the huge amount of flat sail area called windage, is going to be used to help provide some sail area for propulsion. Now, I remain somewhat skeptical, because to me, sail propulsion is Eagle. Sail propulsion is Seadolf, that we talked about last week when the Russians sent her across the Northern Sea route in the summertime. Those are sailing ships. There have been all kinds of efforts to come up with different ways of using some sort of wind power to propel merchant ships built out of steel, and I'm a little bit skeptical of this one. Interestingly enough, there were no drawings, there were no pictures, there were no ways of looking at what this thing might look at so that I could criticize it. We are once again at the end of our time together, and from the captain's chair, my wish, my hope, my command is that each of us who is responsible for other people, watch out for them, watch their six, make sure that they are getting their shots. I'm still not able to get mine yet, but no doubt it is out there in the ether somewhere. And so we never say goodbye. We say until we meet again. And this is, as always, your captain, talking to Captain Joe's people from the captain's chair on station and watching properly.